Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Today we have a special report on journalism in Russia. Now, Russia has changed a lot since the collapse of the Soviet Union. But even though it claims to be a democratic society and a democratic country, well, it doesn't really reflect on journalism. There have been, so far, more than 18 journalists that have been killed in the country in the last 10 years. Official repression and self-censorship have characterized what it's like reporting for local journalists in the country. The issues, of course, came to light around the 2014 Sochi Winter Games. And according to a new report by the Committee to Protect Journalists, you'll also hear about how U.S. journalists have been expelled from the country, more so in the last 30 years than in previous times. We have this special report from Richard Ady.
To understand the latest version of Russia's repressive media climate, you have to go back a couple of years to the end of 2011, after the parliamentary elections, but before the presidential poll that would return Vladimir Putin to the Kremlin. There were huge public protests, and Norman Hammond had a ringside seat as the ABC's Moscow correspondent.
Some of it, if you can recall, was almost unprecedented. I mean, these rallies were so large in scope, people hadn't seen anything like this in the Putin era, certainly, that state television and networks that are generally sympathetic to the Kremlin had no choice to report these rallies. I mean, normally these sorts of protests are given very little coverage, but they were so large that they would have been laughingstocks had they not reported on them. So they actually had to report on the rallies, and it was quite extraordinary seeing not only the big Russian networks, the state networks, but even networks like NTV, which is nominally an independent network, reporting on these rallies and what was happening not only in Moscow but in big cities across the country. So there was this really brief moment where it looked like the media was liberalizing incredibly quickly, and people were thinking back to the heady days of sort of the mid 1990s, when there was this brief period of extremely free media, especially in the mass media, the broadcast media in Russia. And then, of course, as the protest movement started to wane, that changed very quickly.
So once he was elected again, what happened?
Well, that was in May 2012. Mm. And then during the summer, typically what happens is most Russian cities, particularly Moscow, sort of shut down for the summer. The people involved, as funny as it may sound, these people are running a protest movement for the very future of the country, but many of them took extended vacations through that summer and were out of the country. And it lost a lot of momentum. And while that was happening, the media crackdown sort of took place. A lot of that coverage we had been seeing in the mainstream broadcast media sort of disappeared. And there were a number of essentially hit jobs done by either public networks or Kremlin-friendly networks on protest leaders, documentaries about how they had accepted money, all aimed at discrediting the leaders of the protest. And it was for people who remembered Soviet times, there was a real air of familiarity to it, because it did look like a Kremlin-orchestrated campaign in the mass media to try and discredit the opposition. And to a large extent, it really was successful, because outside of Moscow, many people just started to consider people involved with the opposition, the leadership, as no better than the people in the Kremlin, and just somehow trying to get power through another means. So that consistent drumbeat of coverage did seem to sort of wear down the leadership of the opposition.
But reporting critically has become harder too. There's now defamation's now criminal again. You've got things like websites that are blacklisted for carrying unlawful content, which can be interpreted almost however it suits anyone in authority to interpret it. Treason's now been defined so vaguely that it could be that any information shared with an international journalist is an act of espionage.
I think the key, Richard, is it doesn't even have to get that far. If you look at what's happening right now to Dosht TV, Rain Television, which was probably the most independent network in Russia, it was on, it's a small operation that is primarily internet-based and then is carried on cable networks and satellite networks across Russia, and developed a very large following during these protests. And without any of these draconian measures that you're speaking of, they've managed to essentially silence it by putting huge amounts of pressure on cable operators to simply drop the channel. And that's exactly what's happened. So it's now been left to an internet stream. Now, an internet stream in Russia is very good for people who want to see it in Moscow and a few other big cities. But the vast majority of Russians still get their news and information from broadcast media.
Mm-hmm.
And broadcast media is really the key. So once you remove an opposition or an independent voice from broadcast media, it essentially has been removed from the national debate. And that's exactly what they've been moving to do.
So you've been, while you were there doing your own reporting, of course, you were seeing what was happening to Russian journalists reporting for Russian outlets. In the teeth of these law changes and heavy pressure, how did they respond?
Well, sadly, a number of journalists simply complied. Others continue to fight on, but, you know, it's a very complicated picture. For instance, one of the most well-known independent liberal democratic voices in Russia is Echo Radio in Moscow, which is a radio station and has a cable TV network as well that's mostly seen by people over the internet. And it has always operated freely. It continues to ask tough questions of the Kremlin, but there's always been this allegation that it is sort of permitted to operate as an outlet for liberal democratic thought, that it's a way for the Kremlin to be able to point to Westerners and to critics and say, we do allow this kind of discussion. Because when you go outside of Moscow to the rest of Russia, you know, these kind of networks have almost no influence. Virtually, they're not part of the popular conversation. No one is really thinking about them, talking about them. So there are networks like that that exist in isolation. There's other examples of things that happened. For instance, when we were in Russia and we did some reporting on this, there was a media personality. Her name is Ksenia Sobchak, and she comes from a very well-connected family within the Kremlin. And she very sensationally adopted the protests as one of her cause. And she was doing a lot of work on popular television. She wasn't a serious news person, but she would have, you know, was very well known personality on things like what we have in Australia, you know, Australia's Got Talent, being a judge. She was everywhere in the magazines. And within 2 months, she had nothing. She was not on the airwaves anywhere, except for Dosht TV, Rain TV, where she had a show. But essentially, she talked to us very frankly about her career had essentially been reduced to one gig in a matter of months. And it was all due to pressure put on broadcasters from the Kremlin to make these people disappear from the public view, people who supported sort of the protest movement.
Norman Hammond. It's easy to see why the mainstream media hasn't distinguished itself covering Sochi. But according to Nina Ognianova, this has left space for smaller, independent journalists.
That is a phenomenon that has emerged out of the mainstream media silence on Sochi. The local activists, we're talking about environmental activists, rights defenders, even lawyers who defend migrant workers who have been robbed of their salaries or who have been defending evicted residents. This community of brave individuals have taken on the task that usually falls upon journalists. They have been doing that via the social networks, in blogging platforms, on YouTube, and they have been doing that at a great risk for themselves and their own livelihood, as well as for the livelihood of their families. When we did our report, we spoke with many of these activists, and they shared with us their personal stories of harassment, intimidation, bureaucratic raids that they have experienced because they have refused to keep their mouth shut about the evictions, about the corruption, about the environmental damage, and all of the other issues that we just talked about.
Nina Ognianova from the Committee to Protect Journalists.
Russia is one of the most dangerous countries in the world for journalists.
A Russian newspaper reporter died earlier this month when he fell out of an apartment block window.
The very first cup of tea completely incapacitated me. I lost consciousness practically straight away.
Anna Politkovskaya was shot dead outside her Moscow apartment. The 48-year-old won praise and made high-powered enemies with her reporting on Russia's war in Chechnya and for her criticism of the Putin presidency.
His old desk is now a memorial and the story has been shelved.
We want the real murderers to be found.
And now most of the journalists don't speak up what they think.
Ivan Safronov's death made the pages of his newspaper, but few other Russian media bothered to report it.
If you're a Russian journalist, asking too many questions can get you killed. It's different if you're an American foreign correspondent. The worst thing that can happen is being expelled. Though that hasn't occurred since the days of the Cold War. Until last Christmas, that is, when David Satter, a veteran of three stints in Moscow, was kicked out. But it's not only what was done, it's the way it was done. In a very carefully worded statement, he was told that competent organs had determined his presence was undesirable.
The last time an American correspondent was expelled was 1982, when Andrew Nagorsky of Newsweek was expelled. But I've been covering Russia, covering the Soviet Union, actually, for almost four decades. And during that time, I don't know of a single case in which this kind of phrasing was used to justify the expulsion of a correspondent. This is the kind of phraseology that's used when you're talking about espionage. So it was very unusual.
So why did it happen, David?
Well, of course, only the FSB and only the Russian authorities know for sure. I can only guess. In the 3 months that I was in Russia, I simply did not have time to do anything that was that significant. Most of those 3 months were spent setting up an apartment, opening a bank account, taking care of various bureaucratic details. I wrote a couple of articles, but it would certainly not have been enough in and of itself to justify an expulsion. I think it was their assessment of what I've done in the past and what they thought I was capable of doing in the future.
Yes.
That's my best guess.
If their concern was what you'd done in the past, they had a fair bit to choose from, didn't they? But I'm wondering if, in particular, it was the very pointed questions that you've asked about the apartment bombings of 1999, which turned out to be important in the rise of Putin eventually to the presidency, that might have been the key problem.
It's very possible, because the apartment bombings were discussed in my book, Darkness at Dawn, which came out in 2003. The Russian authorities reacted in my case by pretending that what I said didn't exist. But in the case of other people, Russians, who raised the same issues, they dealt with them in a much different way. For example, Alexander Litvinenko was poisoned with a radioactive isotope in London. Yuri Shekhachihin, a Russian journalist, was poisoned. Sergei Yushchenkov, another person who raised this issue, was shot and killed. So this is obviously a very sensitive question.
Well, that's it. And perhaps I should get you to explain why, because we're talking about hundreds of people being killed at these bombings. I think the Chechens...
300.
The Chechens were blamed, but there are at least questions about whether the FSB, so state security, which was then headed by Putin, or he'd perhaps just left there, might not have been responsible themselves.
Well, absolutely. There were four bombings in three cities, two in Moscow, one in Buynaksk, which is in Dagestan, and one in the city of Volgodonsk. And then a fifth bomb was discovered in the basement of an apartment building in Ryazan. It's a city southeast of Moscow. And the local police acted quickly. And the persons who put the bomb in the basement were caught. But to the surprise of everyone, they didn't turn out to be Chechens. They turned out to be agents of the FSB. Now, how do you explain that?
Training exercise, I believe, is what was said at the time.
It was said at the time, but it certainly didn't resemble a training exercise when it took place, and a training exercise can't be conducted with a live bomb. And the bomb was tested, and it tested positive for hexagon, the same explosive that was used in the other bombings.
David, one of the things that occurs to me as you tell this story is that you mentioned the other journalist who asked the hard questions. Three of them are dead. They were Russian. You're alive. You're American. Do you think that's why you are alive?
Very well, that's undoubtedly one of the reasons. We've seen that Russian journalists, Russian investigators, Russian writers are very vulnerable, much more vulnerable than representatives of Western media.
How would you assess their vulnerability if you think, I think something like 18 Russian journalists have been killed in the last 10 years. Are Russian journalists safer now than they were, say, 10 years ago when Putin had fairly recently risen to the top?
No, not at all, because there have been recent cases of either journalists or human rights activists being murdered. For example, Mikhail Beketov in the Khimki region, who wrote about corruption surrounding the construction of a road, projected construction of a road connecting Moscow and Leningrad through the Khimki forest, was savagely beaten and left an invalid and died ultimately from his injuries. And Natalia Estimerova in Grozny was taken out. She was not a journalist herself, but she collected information about human rights abuses and made that information available to journalists. She was kidnapped from her office in Grozny in Chechnya and taken out and murdered and assassinated. So no, it's not stopping. I mean, on the contrary, journalists are just as defenseless and vulnerable now as they were in the past.
All right, but what about the foreign correspondents? Are they now working in a more hostile climate?
Well, I don't think it is hostile in the direct sense, because the Russian authorities try to manipulate and influence the foreign press. And the foreign reporters in Moscow, even those who speak Russian, and many of them do now, oftentimes are at a disadvantage when it comes to penetrating Russian society. They obviously have a tough time knowing Russia as well and in as much depth as Russian reporters do. So what the authorities try to do is to kind of influence them, give them privileged access in return for cooperation, avoiding controversial subjects. Some are invited to the Valdai Discussion Club, so-called, at which they can meet high-level Russian officials who in effect propagandize them. It's a struggle for most foreign reporters really to penetrate the surface of the society.
Which might be why David Satter has his problem, because he's better able than most to do exactly that. Of course, not all foreign correspondents are invited in for drinks and propaganda. Nina Ognianova says one or two have been seriously harassed.
The case with a Norwegian two-person crew for TV2, which is the official Olympic broadcaster for Norway.
Mm. They were detained and threatened, weren't they, those two?
That's right. So Øystein Bogen, a reporter, and his cameraman were traveling in southern Russia through the Republic of Adygea on the way to Sochi to interview local sources about the impact of the Olympics on their lives when in a period of 48 hours they were stopped six times and they were detained three times. During this very unpleasant ordeal, local police intimidated them, threatened to jail them, at some point refused to allow them to call their embassy. Even in one drastic episode, a local policeman tried to force the reporter Bogan to take a drug test. he refused to do so, but the stress and the level of obstruction, I have to say, was unprecedented for an international crew.
Nina Ognianova. Norman Hammond was the ABC's last Moscow correspondent. He's based in Melbourne these days. So what does he miss about the country he describes as invigorating, surprising, amazing and frustrating, all at the same time?
Oh, I definitely miss the feeling that you have, especially when you're in Moscow. And I often tell people it is like London, New York and Los Angeles in terms of culture, economy, you know, entertainment. It's all wrapped into one. And you really do feel that while you're there. And I do miss that. And I miss, the intellectual exercise of trying to figure out what's happening and trying to, determine the best way to explain it to people. Because one of the things you'll hear about journalists in Moscow, foreigners, really experienced journalists, people who've been there for a decade, speak fluent Russian. In another city, by then, they would have, most of these people would have very, very good government contacts. In Moscow, that just doesn't happen. You just don't know what's really going on inside the walls of the Kremlin. And you really have to rely on talking to a lot of people who you think do know and can give you a good idea. But the idea that, oh, I'm going to go to a party and I'm going to meet somebody from the Interior Ministry and we'll become friends and then we'll suddenly meet for coffee, and it just can't happen there. These people are watched too closely and they're too paranoid to meet with foreign journalists and to give them information that way. So it's a difficult place to really know what is going on, but that's part of what makes it so interesting.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard Ady, for that special report. And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from the studios of PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file. The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
All right, now let's turn our attention to propagation, what's been happening over the last 7 days, and what we can expect in the next coming 7 days. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith, from Space Weather Canada, the 27-day magnetic activity forecast starting November 27th. Greatest DRX nanoteslas, especially in the auroral zone, 220 on December 5th, and a lesser peak of 140 December 18th. From Space Weather Services Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through December 2nd. Normal to fair to normal at all latitude bands. From Space Weather South Africa through December 2nd, magnetic conditions quiet to unsettled to quiet. Shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through December 3rd, solar activity very low, no sunspots expected to appear. Geomagnetic conditions mostly quiet. From FK Yanda in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be active to disturbed on December 1st, 4th, 5th, 18th, and 19th. Quiet to unsettled December 2nd, 10th, and 15th. Quiet on December 3rd, 9th, 14th, and 17th. Quiet to active on December 6th, 7th, 11th to 13th, and 20th. Mostly quiet on December 8th and 16th. From the Space Environment Prediction Center, China, planetary A index peaking at 29 on December 4th, 23 on December 18th. Solar flux ranging between 70 and 74 through December 26th. From the Space Weather Prediction Center, Colorado, solar flux 76 through December 2nd, then dropping to 70 on December 5th to 7th, and back up to 76 by December 23rd. G1 minor geomagnetic storm levels December 4th to 7th, peaking at G2, moderate, December 5th, with ANK indices of 40 and 6. Also G1 minor storms, December 18th, with ANK of 25 and 5. Lowest ANKs of 5 and 2 on December 2nd and 3rd, 9th and 10th, 15th and 16th, 22nd and 23rd. RSGB says we are now into the build-up to one of the better meteor showers of the year. The Geminids has a broad peak, culminating on 13 and 14 December. But there are normally many meteors throughout the shower period, giving useful reflections, such as for FMDX meteor bursts.
Thanks, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Just a reminder that we actually have a couple of special programs coming up on the following dates, the 9th of December, 16th, 23rd, and 30th of December. That's actually the next four programs. We actually have a couple of holiday programs coming up as well at the end of the month. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well, hoping that you enjoyed the program, and we'll see you again very, very soon. 73 and 88 to the ladies.
Yeah.